Now, the only air check on the site at this time when we're doing this interview from 1971 sounds very much like the Drake format with the Drake jingles and the Drake presentation. Is that something you were trying to do?
Yes, it was a combination of the Drake format, which gave the station the depth, and then the personalities of each of the jocks. I hired characters that could deliver the format and have fun, and that was really the criteria of the radio station. Now, you have a photograph of Mark Elliott on the site. Mark was the midday guy, and he really hadn't done the type of radio that I wanted to have the guy do in middays. But I took him in the production room, and I gave him a couple of intros to do. I mean, he delivered them just fantastically. He had been in radio before, but he had never done the big sound. Everybody listened to everybody else. Each jock tried to outdo the other jock. It was probably one of the greatest teamworks that I ever was associated with. Each one of the jocks on the station would listen to each other, and they would compliment each other about the bits. They would talk about the bits. They'd talk about what they'd do. They'd meet afterwards at the restaurant and have dinner or drinks or whatever, and they'd all kind of work together to help develop this whole sound that we had. And it was kind of big boy voices doing a real funky kind of, yeah, you'd have to call it double entendre, a little risque, and just having a good time and not taking anybody too seriously, just playing the hits and having a good time.
All right, let's talk about some of those jocks. Lee Gray, you've already talked about. You've talked about Mark Elliott. What about Jim Rivers?
Oh, Jim, he did a great job. I mean, he was always there and always on and always dependable.
Tell me about Chuck Brady.
Oh, Chuck Brady. He was. You see, all of these people, like Lee Gray was a former PD. Chuck Brady, his real name is Jim Felton. He was a program director. They had depth among themselves, and they could get on the air, and they could say more in 10 seconds. Not that we didn't have a 10-second rule at those days, but he could say more in 10 seconds than most air people could say in a whole show. They just took words. They made words happen. They sounded bigger than life. Chuck would never miss a beat. His production was great. His formatics were great. His personality was bigger than life. And he just sounded like he was having a great time on the air.
How about Bill Love?
Brother Love. Brother Love. He was a cool jock. He was a nighttime guy who had all the cool lines. He was a big guy. I don't remember how tall he was. I think about 6'4". Maybe 6'5". He was a big guy. But anyway, either that or I was very short and thought he was big. But he was very relatable to the nighttime audience and just had a super connection with the kids. He knew how to do the one-liners, the request lines, and he just was fabulous. He was a great jock. And he's gone on to become a terrific program director, and I believe he's programming country in Evansville, Indiana, and he's been there for a long time.
Now, he later went on to be the morning guy as Bill Love at KLO. Was that during your time?
No, that was after I left. Actually, he left and came back. I believe he went to WHK in Cleveland. Same with Jonathan Stone. He was another one of the jocks on the station. We also had something else on the station that we hadn't talked about yet, is our news department. When I was there as a jock, of course, Alan Bryan was there, who was fantastic. When I came back, we had Ty Meredith as our news director. Ty was really just a great personality with the news. There's another guy here who we need to talk about, a guy named J.J. Wright. He was kind of an inexperienced jock from some small market in Kentucky. We got together one night. He came up and talked about a job. I introduced him to the staff, a couple of the staff. They liked him. I put him on the air. He did 10 to 2. Was always a super steady performer and a steady Eddie. And the interesting part of this story is that when he left WKLO, he went to Boston, probably left in 73, after being at KLO a couple of years, worked for KISS in Boston, and stayed at KISS in Boston. Still in Boston to this day, and it's an amazing story.
Jack Crawford.
Oh, Jack. He was kind of the copy and production and go-to guy for commercials and things. He worked a lot with Mike Rivers. And I can't say enough about Mike Rivers, by the way. I mean, Mike Rivers had one of the highest IQs of anybody I've ever known, and he just was super creative and that was really his bailiwick. And he and I worked together to create contests and promotions because we had to work behind the scenes because Ernie, God love him, was just not into doing what I felt we needed to do, which was really spend money on outside promotions. Because Wacky was a very strong radio station, and Johnny Randolph was a very sharp program director. He did a hell of a job over there. And Mike Rivers was, you know, a great help and attribute in unseating the Wacky numbers. It was probably one of the toughest battles that was ever fought, and it was a lot of fun. And Johnny Randolph was an excellent music director at Wacky. You know, he and I were in this big music fight, and Rivers really gave me a big edge on the production because we had to utilize production sometimes to offset the dollars you'd spend in outside promotions like billboards or television. My favorite was when the Chuck Berry song came out. It's funny how what goes around comes around. Chuck Berry had the hit My Ding-a-Ling. It was a number one song. In fact, it was the only number one song that Chuck Berry ever had. Wacky would not play the song. So I put the song on, and I played it every hour. And then we let people win their own ding-a-ling, so they'd have their own ding-a-ling to play with, which was basically three balls on a string. I remember sitting in my office putting them together. You know, three little jingle bells.
There's a picture of Chuck Brady holding one on the website.
Yeah, absolutely. And there was the My Ding-a-ling contest, and that little contest created so much buzz. Between that and we gave away the chess boards, the production on that was so huge, you would have thought we were giving away $5 million.
I think his promos were even better than the ones that Jack McCoy did for the last contest at KCBQ.
There is no question about that. And that's not being detrimental to Jack at all. But Mike, his production, he was just a master with tape scissors, the synthesizer, and voice work and phasing. And it was ahead of its time, if you know what I mean. The other thing was interesting is that the engineer, Bruce Clark, he was the chief engineer, but he was deaf. So Mike and I used to have to go crank up the sound on the radio station to help us get the sound we wanted. So KLO developed kind of a real big presence, if you know what I'm saying. And I noticed that on Mike Rivers' piece, he was telling about the speeding the turntables up. I put that in. What I wanted was I wanted brass shafts made, you know, to speed them up. You just get the shafts tooled and pop them in there, and they speed the turntables up. Well, what happened was is that Ernie, in a meeting, I told him what I wanted, and I don't know, it was $125 or something, whatever it was, and he didn't want to spend the money to get it done. So I said, okay, fine. So in talking to Rivers, he says, well, we can do that with tape. So we did. And we taped the shafts, and we achieved the sound. And then one day during maintenance, what we didn't realize, we used Scotch tape. And if you use Scotch tape on there, it, you know, it's hot down there, so it eventually melts and gets gummy. One day, the engineers in doing maintenance, and they discover this, and they went ape bananas. Of course, Ernie then got in the middle of it, and the next thing I know, when I reported to work on that Monday morning or whatever it was I was called into his office, and he's like, Bill, understand the turntables are all gummed up. And so the story came out how we achieved our goal without buying the shafts, so he eventually acquiesced and bought the shafts, and we were back in business.
Let's talk about Wacky for a little bit. When you were program director of KLO the second time that you were there, you probably paid a lot more attention to Wacky than you did as a jock.
Oh, yeah. I was up against Bailey in the morning, and Randolph was on the air, and Gary Burbank. There were some formidable personalities on this radio station that had a great image in the marketplace.
How did you combat that?
Our strength became stationality. Instead of working on everybody having a totally unique sound, we worked on developing a station sound, and the jocks were part of that big picture. They all had personality, but Wacky was talking more, and we were playing more music. It was a battle where we would move the news, and Wacky would move the news. It was what you call the day of real counter-programming, okay? At one point, I got tired of moving the news, so I just put in some real long music sweeps way ahead of its time. And all of a sudden, when I put these music sweeps in, and I didn't move the news around, let it sit where it was, all of a sudden, the station man just kind of took off. I mean, it wasn't just because of that, but I'm just saying that we were in this real competitive back-and-forth, head-to-head battle. It was just great. Also, I'd have to say they were a little more country than we were. And by that, I don't mean they sounded like a bunch of yokums. I don't mean that. I mean, musically, they leaned a little bit more country. And I recognized that there was a huge opening in KLO against Wacky in Louisville to utilize the urban sound, which was huge. I mean, it was selling like crazy, but Wacky wasn't playing a lot of it. So KLO, I leaned them more urban, and Wacky leaned a little more country. They played some urban, and we played some country, but they leaned more country. So we went after more of the funk sound, and we gave KLO a more energized, funky stationality. We just wanted to make sure we were playing great music. We also played long versions. We played the long version of American Pie. We played the long version of Superstition by Stevie Wonder. If Led Zeppelin had a long version, we played it. We combined the hip elements, if you follow me. The hip album tracks, not non-hit stuff, but the hip track. And we also played the hit R&B of the time, so we had kind of a funky-sounding and friendly-sounding radio station. That was the basic game plan, and it worked very well.
All right, so why did you leave KLO?
I had an opportunity to go to Detroit. That's my hometown, Detroit, and I had an opportunity to go program CKLW, one of the biggest, in those days, biggest radio stations in America, the Big Eight, as it's called. And to work with a music director who I had a great rapport with and a great deal of respect, Rosalie Trombley.
And so real quickly, after CKLW, what did you do after that?
After CK, I went on to become the national program director of Ray Hall Broadcasting, which was headquartered in Indianapolis, WNDE. And I put the original WFBQ on the air into a music mode and moved that station forward in more of a live mode. Actually, FBQ was a stepchild station in those days. From there, I went to Philadelphia, Wi-Fi in Philadelphia, and from Wi-Fi in Philadelphia to Chicago, where I worked for NBC, WMAQ, which became the largest country station in America with a cum of over 2 million, and WKQX, the FM. I programmed both of those stations in Chicago. And then after 4 years there, I decided to go in the consulting business, and I opened up Bill Hennison Associates Program Consulting. And I do consulting work for radio stations, and I have since 1981 in all formats. And then 5.5 years ago, I launched a website, which has become the biggest website for country radio to get their news and information from, called allaboutcountry.com.
Bill, why do you think WKLO is so important in the history of Top 40 radio of the 60s and 70s?
Because it's one of the great Top 40 radio stations. It had tons of wonderful people that went through it. It had creative talent. It was basically a fine-tuned Top 40 radio station from the beginnings of when it was first started in the early 60s through when Terrell put it back together. It just has a very strong presence in the Top 40 community. You know, Wacky had a stronger signal, if you know what I'm saying. So Wacky tends to get a lot of the notoriety, if you will. It's kind of like my hometown, Detroit. We had a ton of really good Top 40 stations, but most of them were not on good signals. So the only ones you really hear about in Detroit were either Keener or CKLW. I mean, it was always competitive, for the most part, between Wacky and KLO. It was a dogfight for many years and a lot of fun. And whenever you have two of those things really going head-to-head, it makes the talent press stronger to do a better job, and therefore you have better radio stations.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for your time today. I know that thousands of people will enjoy hearing your comments on 1080WKLO.com. And before I end, I have to do at least one thing. I want to do an audition for WKLO in 1971, okay?
Okay.
All right, here we go.
Hold on, let me type something up for you.
Well, no, I know exactly. I've been practicing this ever since I knew that I was going to do the interview with you, okay? Now tell me if I could make it as a KLO jock back in 1971. Here we go. 1080 KLO. L-O!
No, it's the big 1080.
Oh, man, I messed it up.
See, it's the big 1080, W-K-L-O. No, you're fine.
Bill, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Hey, you're welcome. I enjoyed reliving some of the memories, thoughts, and craziness of a wonderful, wonderful time.